I think the better way is a boycott. If we don't like, you know, a certain product, if we don't like a Pepsi Cola or Bank of America, or if you don't like what they do, don't use them. That's the way I see the, you know, people's power is.
You have a lot more money than me. You have more votes than I do. If we use the model of boycott and voting with your dollars, that's an undemocratic situation.
People that say they fear their government, I really hope that they understand that they're allowed to participate in their government. They're not allowed to participate in anything the corporations do. So don't fear the government. Help it be the government that you won't fear.
This is beyond my wildest dreams. To see people talking to each other as if there's something we could do, as if we could figure something out, you know?
As a result of Measure F, Arcata capped the number of chain restaurants at present numbers 9 and banned their future development anywhere in the city. Licking and Porter Townships in Pennsylvania, however, made history by adopting ordinances that eliminate a corporation's ability to claim any constitutional rights as a person.
We know what we need. It's actually a fairly simple set of steps. What we don't have is the political will.
We can change the government. That's the only way we're going to redesign, rethink, reconstitute what capital and property can do.
So what we need to do is to look at the very roots of the legal form that created this beast, and we need to think, who can them accountable?
They're not graven in stone. They can be dismantled. In fact, most states have laws which require that they be dismantled.
Jim Lafferty, National Lawyers Guild.
For too long now, giant corporations have been allowed to undermine democracy here in the United States and all over the world. But today, the National Lawyers Guild and 29 other groups and individuals are fighting back. We are calling upon State Attorney General Dan Lundgren to comply with California law and to revoke the corporate charter of the Union Oil Company of California for its repeated and grievous offenses.
Robert Benson, professor of law, UCLA.
Amidst us, giant corporations who are repeat offenders year after year, decade after decade, this is a statute that is well known. It has been used. It can be used. What this will mean is the dissolution of the Union Oil Company of California, the sale of its assets under careful court orders to others who will carry on in the public interest.
Jim Robinson, U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
This is nothing more than just a smear campaign. This company has been part of California's economy for over 100 years, thousands of jobs. Doesn't mean it's never made any mistakes, paid for those mistakes, but this demonizing of a company, I think I'm in a time warp or something, that I fell asleep and I woke up 50 years ago when we heard that kind of rhetoric.
Well, we have a very, very broad set of people angry,
well,
very
a broad
angry
set
at this corporation.
People from the left of the spectrum who don't produce anything except hot air.
Jim Lafferty.
From its complicity in unspeakable human rights violations overseas against women, gays, laborers, and indigenous peoples, to its efforts to subvert U.S. foreign policy and deceive the courts, the public, and its own stockholders, Unocal is emblematic of corporate abuse and corporate power run amok.
Don Jujang, Burmese refugee.
Extending a business deal with Burma Army is immoral. It prolongs the iron rule in Burma. The pipeline Unocal is building in Burma is a vital for survival, cash-strapped army. Unocal cannot do business in Burma without supporting that hopeless regime.
The Attorney General of California refused to revoke the corporate charter of Unocal, but did acknowledge that his office had the power to do so. The Attorney General of New York recently revoked the charters of two, quote, research organizations, which he described as tobacco industry shills.
Commerce and government are not primary, they're secondary institutions. They are derivative of the primary institution, which is the culture where people live their lives. Understanding this is the key to this debate about globalization.
Jeremy Rifkin, President, Foundation on Economic Trends.
If we can begin to reestablish culture as the center where people's power is, then there's a role for corporations and there's a role for government. But those roles are to be attended to, not dominant over the place where people have their story told and where they live out their community values.
Michael Moore.
The curse for me has been the fact that in making these documentary films, I've seen that they actually can impact change. So I'm just compelled to, you know, keep making them.
Yep, that's me, doing what I do. All year long, I give big companies a hard time. But at Christmas time, I like to set aside my differences and reach out to big business, like cigarette companies.
Deck the halls with boughs of holly. Tis the season to be jolly.
The awful truth, there was a guy whose healthcare insurance provider said that they would not pay for his pancreas transplant. Even though it was clear that they had to do that, they weren't going to do it. They were going to let him die. We showed up with our cameras and conducted a funeral rehearsal for this guy on the lawn of their corporate headquarters.
I didn't know Chris for very long. He was a great guy. He had a lot of integrity, a rich sense of humor. And in fact, I remember something that he often used to say.
What was he used to say?
Just want a pancreas.
He used to say, I just want a pancreas.
Within 3 days, this company turns around and says, okay, we'll pay for his transplant.
We have the good fortune of having Chris with us here tonight.
So somebody actually lived as a result of this kind of work.
And his daughter, Brittany.
I went to Littleton, Colorado, where the Columbine shooting took place. And I didn't know this, but when I arrived, I learned what the primary job is of the parents of the kids who go to Columbine High School. The number one job in Littleton, Colorado, they work for Lockheed Martin, building weapons of mass destruction. But they don't see the connect between what they do for a living and what their kids do at school or did at school. And so I'm kind of, up on my, high horse, thinking about this. And I thought, I said to my wife, we both are, sons and daughters of auto workers in Flint, Michigan. There isn't a single one of us back in Flint, any of us, including us, who ever stopped to think, this thing we do for a living, the building of automobiles, is probably the single biggest reason why the polar ice caps are going to melt and end civilization as we know it. There's no connect between, I'm just an assembler on an assembly line building a car, which is good for people in society. It moves them around. But never stop to think about the larger picture and the larger responsibility of what we're doing. Ultimately, we have to, as individuals, accept responsibility for our collective action and the larger harm that it causes in our world.
There are many tools for bringing back community, but the importance is not the tools. I mean, there's litigation, there's legislation, there's direct action, there's education, boycotts, social investment.
Jeremy Rifkin.
There's many, many ways to address issues of corporate power, but in the final analysis, what's really important is the vision. You have to have a better story.
And until we redefine our relationship to nature, the power that we have given to these transnational corporations, the international institutions that serve them, and the non-democratic governments that we have, we will not be able to stop this destruction.
Mary Zebernick.
One thing we talk about is the importance of seeing ourselves as part of the natural world, not apart from it.
Do I know you well enough to call you fellow plunderers? There is not an industrial company on earth, not an institution of any kind, not mine, not yours, not anyone's, that is sustainable.
Ray Anderson, addressing civic and business leaders, North Carolina State University.
I stand convicted by me, myself alone, not by anyone else, as a plunderer of the earth. But not by our civilization's definition. By our civilization's definition, I'm a captain of industry in the eyes of many a kind of modern-day hero. But really, really, the first industrial revolution is flawed. It is not working. It is unsustainable. It is the mistake. And we must move on to another and better industrial revolution and get it right this time. When I think of what could be, I visualize an organization of people committed to a purpose. And the purpose is doing no harm. I see a company that has severed the umbilical cord to Earth for its raw materials, taking raw materials that have already been extracted and using them over and over again, driving that process with renewable energy. What progress have we made? From 1995 to 1996, our sales increased by $200 million. The amount of material that we extracted from the earth to feed our factories was essentially the same 1.2 billion pounds as in 1995. In other words, the $200 million of incremental sales came with no additional extracted throughput. That is, at practically no additional cost to Earth. It is perhaps the first $200 million of truly sustainable business in the history of industry. It is our plan, it remains our plan, to climb Mount Sustainability, that mountain that's higher than Everest, infinitely higher than Everest, far more difficult to scale. That point at the top, symbolizing zero footprint. But before I die, I want to see the top in the view from there.
Ira Jackson, Kennedy School, Harvard.
3 billion of us still live in poverty. And half of the half who live in poverty are children. So capitalism is doing well, but it's leaving many behind. And I think we should be concerned about whether that gap doesn't increase.
Ultimately, capital puts its foot down somewhere. And anywhere it puts its foot down, it can be held accountable if we're prepared to do that.
I would make sure that the people who work at these corporations have a say in what's going on, that they're more democratically formed, not just the board of directors or a couple of executives are making these decisions.
Charles Kernighan, Director, National Labor Committee.
We were in Honduras, and some workers, they knew the kind of work that we did, and they approached us, these young workers, and they said, conditions in our factory are horrible. Will you please meet with us? And we said we would, but you can't meet in the developing world. You can't walk up to a factory with your notebook and workers come out and interview them. I mean, there's goons, there's spies, the military police. So you do everything in a clandestine manner. So we said to the women, go on down the road, about 100 yards. There's a food stand, and the owner is a secret supporter of human rights. We're about to start the meeting, and in walk three guys, very tough-looking guys. The company had found out about a meeting and sent these spies. So the women jump to their feet and they say, these guys are spies. We can't meet. We have to call the meeting off. Everything we say is going back to the boss. We're all lose our jobs, or worse. Obviously, we didn't have the meeting. But these young girls were really bright. I was standing next to an old table. And as they were leaving, away from the eyesight of the spies, they started to put their hands underneath the table. And I put my palm under there, put my hand under there, and they put into my hand their pay stubs. So we'd know who they were, what they were paid, and the labels that they made in the factory, so we'd know who they worked for. And I took my hand out after everyone had left, and in the palm of my hand was the face of Kathy Lee Gifford. But the bottom of it is the interesting part. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of this garment will be donated to various children's charities. It's very touching. Get your right here. Walmart is telling you if you purchase these pants, and Kathy Lee is telling you purchase these pants, you're going to help children. The problem was the people who handed us the label were 13 years of age. By the way, she's forbidden me to speak about her, but I can't help myself. So I have a blow-up and I carry it around. Originally, Walmart and Kathy Lee Gifford had said, why should we believe you that children work in this factory?
What we didn't tell them was that Wendy Diaz, in the center of the picture, was on a plane to the United States. This is Wendy Diaz.
She comes to the United States. She's unstoppable.
Congress heard testimony today from children who testified they were exploited by sweatshops overseas.
Kathy Lee Gifford apologized to Wendy Diaz. It was the most amazing thing I'd seen. This powerful celebrity leans over and says, Wendy, please believe me. I didn't know these conditions existed. And now that I do, I'm going to work with you. I'm going to work with these other people, and it'll never happen again. And that night we signed an agreement with Kathy Lee Gifford.
I thought it would be a relatively easy process, and it isn't. Now, for every question I have, there seem to be five questions that come back at me. We have been...
As far as Walmart goes and Kathy Lee, pretty much everything returned to sweatshop conditions. But because this was fought out on television for weeks, this incident with Kathy Lee Gifford actually took the sweatshop issue to every single part of the country. And so, frankly, after that, there's hardly a single person in this country who doesn't know about child labor or sweatshops or starvation wages. And we're preparing a campaign. If the label's protected, so should the 60-year-old who made that label. So if the label's protected under international copyrights and intellectual property rights, if it's protected under WTO, that's fine. But the 60-year-old is going to have every bit as much protection as that label.
Several years after the Walmart controversy, Kathy Lee handbags were still being made in China by workers paid 3 cents per hour. Under pressure from the National Labor Committee, Gap Incorporated allowed independent monitoring of its El Salvador factories, becoming the first transnational corporation to do so anywhere.
We need to determine that certain things shouldn't be bought and sold. You can have a price on anything. You can have a price on humans.
Alain Bernard.
We've done it. It was called slavery. We didn't experience market failure one day, you know, sell slaves, let's get out of the business. It took an immense social worldwide movement to try to abolish the slave trade and eventually slavery. And what did we do? We took a commodity, human beings, out of the marketplace because we said there is a moral order and it takes precedence over markets.
I started this phase of my life, literally 87, both under the awareness made directly by the big corporations that told us that by the turn of the century, five companies would be controlling our food and health through patents and genetic engineering and corporate mergers, as well as the Uruguay Round of GATT, which was drawing in intellectual property rights and patents into a world trading system. And that's when I decided this is what I must work on, because it was really about the most fundamental fabric of our moral existence.
Dr. Vandana Shiva.
Over the past decade, we have been gaining ground. And when I say we, I mean ordinary people committed to the welfare of all of humanity, all people irrespective of gender and class and race and religion, all species on the planet. We managed to take the biggest government and one of the largest chemical companies to court on the case of Neem and win a case against them. W.R. Grace and the U.S. government's patent on Neem was revoked by a case we brought along with the Greens of Europe in Parliament and the International Organic Agriculture Movement. We won because we worked together. We have overturned nearly 99% of the Basmati patent of RiceTech. Again, because we worked as a worldwide coalition, old women in Texas, scientists in India, activists sitting in Vancouver, a little Basmati action group. When countries are challenging TRIPS and asking for review and change in the agreement, they use the language of biopiracy. We stopped the third world being viewed as the pirate, and we showed the corporations were the pirate. How little it took for Gandhi to work against the salt laws of the British, where the British decided the way they would make their armies and police forces bigger is just tax the salt. And all that Gandhi did was walk to the beach, pick up the salt, and say, nature gives it for free, we need it, we've always made it, we will violate your laws, we will continue to make salt. We've had a similar commitment for the last decade in India. We call it the beet satyagraha, the seed satyagraha, that any law that makes it illegal to save seed is a law not worth following. We will violate it because saving seed is a duty to the earth and to future generations. We thought it would really be symbolic. It is more than symbolic. It is becoming a survival option. Farmers who grow their own seeds, save their own seeds, don't buy pesticides, have threefold more incomes than farmers who are locked into the chemical treadmill, depending on Monsanto and Cargill. We have managed to create alternatives that work for people.
Don't we have to start first and foremost by re-examining what's the purpose of this enterprise? And if the answer continues to remain profitability and shareholder satisfaction,
I reject.
It's not a satisfactory enough answer.
There's a great old joke. Two economists are looking at a bunch of formulae on a blackboard, and one says to the other, you know, I find that this model works a lot better if you leave the people out.
Mark Kingwell.
Economists, especially right-wing economists, like to say there's a model of rational, self-interested behavior which defines human life, human desire. But of course, what they can't countenance in that model is departures from what they call rational self-interest, which happen all the time. We have to complicate the model. There may be other directed actions rather than self-directed actions, self-sacrifice, minimization of profit for the sake of some other value, and so on and so on. And this, of course, is not news to any human, but it is news to a lot of economists because that's not the way they have conceived the world. You know, we should take some time and notice this discrepancy because it's the key to rebuilding the picture such that it's richer and more human. And not so much about profit.
Richard Gross.
So we've got to undo a lot of things in order to be smart enough to do this really dangerous and risky and difficult work, you know, the best way that we possibly can. And that means people coming together and learning an whole lot of stuff that we just don't know, that has been driven out of the culture, driven out of the society, driven out of our minds. That, to me, is the most exciting thing. That is happening. It's happening all over the world now.
Estas son las imágenes que reflejan definitivamente la situación que vivió Cochabamba durante la jornada de este viernes. Prácticamente estuvo sitiada. Policías del departamento.
Bolivia was determined to defend the Bechtel Corporation's right to charge families living on $2 a day as much as one quarter of their income for water. The greater the popular resistance to the water privatization scheme, the more violent became the standoff.
Gabriel Airbus. These images definitely show what the city of Cochabamba looked like during this Friday. The city was near a state of siege. I was arrested in front of my family. I was also psychologically tortured. We were taken handcuffed and blindfolded to a remote military post bordering Brazil. Oscar Oliveira, Bolivian water rights activist. There were hundreds of young people, 16 or 17-year-olds, who lost their arms or legs, or who were left handicapped for life by brain injuries. And Victor Hugo Daza was killed. At the beginning, I feared for my family, but they are prepared to face any circumstances. I'm also prepared for it. I lost my fear like the people did. I'm not afraid of dying, but I'd like to live a bit longer so I can keep on fighting. At the climax of the struggle, the army stayed in their barracks. The police also remained in their stations. The members of Congress became invisible. The governor went into hiding, and afterwards he resigned. There wasn't any authority left. The only legitimate authority was the people gathered in the city square making decisions in large assemblies. And at the end, they made the decisions about the water. I think people, all of us, old and young, were able to taste, to quench our thirst for democracy. We inherited a state company with technical problems and with financial and legal problems, with administrative problems. We are dealing with all of them. If we could prove that ordinary working people are able to resolve their own problems, we could be facing the possibility that all which was privatized in the hands of corporations could be returned to the people's hands. Through a secret World Bank tribunal, Bechtel sought $25 million in compensation for its losses in Bolivia. Cochabamba's victory over Bechtel cost 6 dead and 175 injured, including 2 children blinded by tear gas. Inspired by Cochabamba's example, popular movements around the world continue to successfully resist water privatization schemes.
After we beat the Gap, I walk past these Gap stores and I look at them. I think, my God, there's like 2,000 inch stores across the country. Look at all that concrete. Look at the glass. Look at all the staff people. Look at all the clothing. Look at that power. You can still reach these companies. You can still have an effect.
Yo creo que sí hemos ganado, se están ganando pequeñas batallas en el mundo.
Oscar Oliveira.
Pero yo creo que la gente está perdiendo la guerra. En eso sí, yo veo...
Small battles are being won around the world, but I think people are losing. I do see the present and the future of our children as very dark. But I trust the people's capacity for reflection, rage, and rebellion.
15 corporations would like to control the conditions of our life. And millions of people are saying, not only do we not need you, we can do it better. We are going to create systems that nourish the earth and nourish human beings. And these are not marginal experiments. They are the mainstay of large numbers of communities across the world. That is where the future lies.
Oscar Oliveira. I didn't expect the company to go. For me, it was an impossible hope. Many of us thought the same as I. I was anguished in my heart because I had to express something I didn't believe in. So I learned at that time a very important lesson. One should never underestimate the power of the people. Seeing that slogan, as I always have, repeated in the demonstrations, "The people united will never be defeated," become a reality was just incredible for me.
You know, I've often thought it's very ironic that I'm able to do all this, and yet what am I on? I'm on networks, I'm distributed by studios that are owned by large corporate entities. Now, why would they put me out there?
Michael Moore.
When I am opposed to everything that they stand for, and I spend my time on their dime opposing what they believe in. Okay? Well, it's because they don't believe in anything. They put me on there because they know that there's millions of people that want to see my film or watch the TV show, and so they're going to make money. And I've been able to get my stuff out there because I'm driving my truck through this incredible flaw in capitalism, the greed flaw, the thing that says the rich man will sell you the rope to hang himself with if he thinks he can make a buck off it. Well, I'm the rope. I hope. I'm part of the rope. And, they also believe that when people watch my stuff or maybe watch this film or whatever, they think that, you know, well, you know what, they'll watch this and they won't do anything, you know, because we've done such a good job of numbing their minds and dumbing them down. You know, they'll never affect it. The people aren't going to leave the couch and go and do something political. They're convinced of that. I'm convinced of the opposite. I'm convinced that a few people are going to leave this movie theater or get up off the couch and go and do something, anything, to get this world back in our hands.
You've been listening to a radio adaptation of part 3 of a 3-part documentary, The Corporation, directed by Mark Akbar and Jennifer Abbott, produced by Mark Akbar and Bart Simpson, written by Joel Bakken, based on his book, The Corporation: The Pathological Pursuit of Profit and Power. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, 91.3 Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. In Pennsylvania, rural communities are fighting corporate colonization and winning. Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio has more on this exciting new movement.
We are talking today with attorney Thomas Lindsay. He is executive director with the organization Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. Thomas, thanks for spending time with us today.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having us, Mike.
Start out and tell us about your organization.
Well, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund was started in 1995, and it was really created to do one thing, which was to provide free legal services to community organizations, mostly environmental groups, grassroots environmental groups, and also to rural municipal governments, primarily in Pennsylvania.
You guys have, according to your website, about four different primary programs, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Not to get into too much of the mundane, but we do a range of different things at the Legal Defense Fund, and the program areas reflect that. Just to talk about two of them, one is an administrative and technical support program whereby we provide things like nonprofit and corporation processing for community groups, with the understanding that in the beginning, the goal was and still is to establish sustainable community organizations that are able to raise funds, perhaps put on a staff person, pay for gas, photocopies, those types of things to become sustainable. And the second of our four program areas is called the Corporations and Democracy Program, which was really created under the recognition that we were working with a lot of community groups and environmental groups especially to do things like permit appeals, to enforce environmental regulations, the type of stuff that conventional environmental attorneys do. But increasingly, over the 3 years that we did that work, even though we got awards from different organizations and we were invited to the White House's Environment Day during Al Gore and Bill Clinton's tenure, that we understood that, or began to understand, that conventional environmental law was really like an energy sink of sorts. And it was an energy sink because we would go out and we would win these permit appeals, or we would win environmental impact statement cases, or we would enforce a regulation here against an incinerator or a landfill or a factory farm or sewage sludge being applied to land. But in the end, 6 months later, a year later, the corporation or the government agency would simply come back, fill in the holes that we had identified during the litigation process that resulted in an overturning of the permit or moving the project back somehow, and eventually would get approved to do the project. And so the Corporations and Democracy Program was really established to work on creative strategies to assert local control and community rights over the rights of corporations. And that's probably one of our most exciting areas. We also do litigation and a couple other things, but that's a good overview.
So is your primary focus on helping citizens against corporations or against government agencies?
Well, to us, it's all about problem solving. And for instance, just to use the example that we're probably most widely cited for, starting in the late 1990s, Pennsylvania was targeted, rural Pennsylvania especially, north and south central Pennsylvania. We have an old joke in Pennsylvania, and I was born in Alabama, so I can tell it. But the old joke goes, we have Pittsburgh on one side of the state, Philadelphia on the other side of the state, and Mississippi in the middle. And it's in Mississippi that we do our work. It's 80% rural, conservative, Republican territory. And the folks that we work with in rural Pennsylvania are the guys with the John Deere hats and the steel-toe boots and the folks that, at least at the municipal level, actually plow the roads and salt the roads in the wintertime and maintain them in the summertime. What the factory farm corporations, keeping in mind that four corporations now control over 70% of pork production in the United States, that when the four corporations that control pork production here in this country decided to open up Pennsylvania to drive these corporate factory farms, these livestock assembly facilities into Pennsylvania, into rural Pennsylvania, the last thing they expected was a revolt of sorts. And we've come to naming it, what's happening in Pennsylvania, the Keystone Rebellion, where you have folks in rural Pennsylvania who have simply said, we don't want those things here. We don't want agribusiness corporations to come into our community to set up these 4,000-head hog factory farms. We want to be able to say no. And in working with them, you know, they called us and we came in. We service some of the elected officials in 400 elected municipal governments in central Pennsylvania. That these rural elected officials and the communities they represented, they didn't want to regulate these hog factory farms a little better. They didn't want to have them cause release two parts per billion or a million ammonia particulates rather than four parts per million ammonia particulates. They wanted to say no. They didn't want to better regulate the facilities to make them cause a little less damage. What they learned the hard way was that law, especially environmental law, has nothing to do with saying no. What environmental law has to do with is enabling you to get the facility or the project or the siting to simply cause a little less harm to the community in which it's being sited. And so here, in effect, these rural folks, perhaps the most unlikeliest of people in the most unlikeliest of places, came forward and said, this isn't good enough. It's not good enough just to be able to regulate these things a little better. We want to control them. And in the process, we want to control the authority of agribusiness corporations to define what farming looks like within our community. And that set us out on a course that took us far and away from the original work that we had done here with permit appeals and enforcing regulatory regimes. And there's actually an old saying that's popped up every now and then here, which is, the only thing that environmental regulations regulate is environmentalists. Because it regulates how predictable we are when we respond to certain things coming in. For instance, a hog factory farm coming in, the law tells you that all you can do is appeal a permit to the Department of Environmental Protection here in the state. And once again, that wasn't good enough for these folks in rural Pennsylvania who believe in democracy. They believe in self-governance, self-determination, community control, local control, and believe that they should have the right to be self-governing and to say no to these things coming in. And that took us over the past 5 years into places where we never envisioned going before.
That's inspiring that you're making headway with that. Can you tell us what kind of batting average you've been looking at?
Sure. In conventional environmental terms, I guess we're batting 1,000. Generally, when you do these permit appeals, you lose about 90% of them. But in Pennsylvania, when we decided to do things a different way, keeping in mind that it wasn't us with a silver bullet coming into a community saying, hey, we've got all the answers for you. These were communities coming to us saying, we're not happy with this regulatory stuff, this regulatory system. We don't want to just get these things to cause a little less harm. We want to be able to keep them out, period. And in doing so, they were doing something much more, I want to use the word radical, but it's not radical to us at all anymore. It's basically become a very logical process and a logical step for folks to look for other options and other alternatives. And lo and behold, in doing work and research for these municipal governments, we tripped over backwards, basically, because the nightly news never covers anything like this, but that 9 states in the Midwest, keeping in mind that these states in the Midwest have hog factory farms of 150,000 or 200,000 head that they've been dealing with for the past 40 years. In Pennsylvania, what we have is relatively boutique, 4,000, 5,000 head hog factory farms. And we figured if anybody had come up with an option that would enable communities to just say no to corporate assaults on their community, surely it was these folks in the Midwest. And what we tripped over was that since 1914 in places like Oklahoma, and since then in 8 other states in addition to Oklahoma, that the citizens of those states, mostly by referenda, have passed laws, statewide laws, that ban agribusiness corporations from owning or controlling farms. I'll say that again because I think it's so important. Banning agribusiness corporations from owning or controlling farms. At some point, folks in those states said, it's not enough to deal with water pollution or air pollution or the odor from these facilities. Not only do we think focusing on the activities is the wrong tack to take, but we're going to shift gears and focus on the actors. Because what we're really talking about here is not air pollution or water pollution or those other things that environmental groups work on. It is those things, but it's something much larger. It's the corporatization of agriculture in this country, in which control and concentration of agricultural production is going into smaller and smaller number of corporate hands. At this point, 5 corporations own 70% of chicken production, 4 corporations own 70% of pork production, 4 corporations own 80% of beef production in this country. So when we talk about why we've lost 300,000 family farmers over the past 20 years, or in Pennsylvania alone that 3,500 livestock family farmers have been driven out of business, it's because there's a process involved, and the process is this corporatization of agriculture. These folks in the Midwest got it long before we did, and they passed these laws to ban agribusiness corporations from owning or controlling farms. That was fairly amazing to us that that happened. In the courts, because we always ask ourselves, although sometimes it's not as important as we think it is, about what the courts did with these things when they got into litigation over these laws. And lo and behold, the U.S. Supreme Court back in 1948 and every federal and state court looking at the question of whether states have the authority to pass laws banning agribusiness corporations from owning or controlling farms all came to the same conclusion. They upheld those laws as a legitimate exercise of power by those citizens of those states. So faced with that history of what folks have done in the Midwest, we asked ourselves, well, what do we do with this? And the answer was very straightforward. We stole them. We went into South Dakota, and we took their law, which, by the way, is not just a statute, but part of the Constitution. Two states, Nebraska and South Dakota, drove these laws into the state constitutions. We took those. We reworked them into local ordinances, local laws that could be passed by the municipal governments that we've been working with. And we refashioned them with a citizen supervision to allow citizens to come in and enforce the laws as well as the enforcement officers in the locality. And we gave these to our municipal officials and worked with them to get an understanding of the process of what was really taking place in Pennsylvania with eliminating family farmers and putting corporations in place for this perverted view of agriculture, or corporate farming as it's called. To date, a dozen municipal governments that we work with have adopted those laws. You ask what the batting average is, and in this situation, with those dozen municipalities that were targeted for hog factory farms prior to 1997, and then they began passing these laws. Not one new factory farm has sited in those areas. So the batting average for those folks is perfect. At the same time that we started dealing with the corporate factory farm issue, we got involved with this land application of sewage sludge issue. A lot of folks don't know, but 60% of all the sludge produced by sewage treatment plants in the United States is applied to cropland. It's where we grow our crops to be fed to livestock, but also fed to humans as cereal crops. And we used to dump it in the ocean, and then it killed a stretch of ocean from off the East Coast. And so the brain surgeons that gave us ocean disposal of sewage sludge now came up with this plan 10 years ago to put sludge on farmland. And the question is, why is that a dangerous practice? Well, sewage sludge can contain over 800,000 different toxic contaminants. The EPA and the state departments of environmental protection test for a grand total of 11. And so we really don't know what's in this stuff. In Pennsylvania, two kids have died after coming into contact with land-applied sewage sludge. And so some of the municipalities that had watched us, these rural community groups, these environmental organizations, these rural local governments, who had watched us deal with the corporate factory farm issue in partnership with some of their fellow or neighboring elected governments, came to us and asked us whether we could do the same thing with the sludge issue. And so we drafted a sludge ordinance that focused on the sludge corporations. A lot of people don't know this, but four national corporations control 70% of the sludge hauling industry in the United States. So we're talking about the corporatization of the waste management industry, parallel to the corporatization of farming or agriculture. We produced this ordinance, and then we worked with municipal governments to begin passing them. To date, 72 municipal governments in Pennsylvania have adopted that ordinance. And going back to your question about batting averages, all 72, whereas prior to the year 2000, they were slated to get sewage sludge, not one new teaspoonful of sewage sludge has been spread in those locations. And so purely from a more effective, you know, how do we be more effective as activists or as organizers or as lawyers or as community leaders or rural municipal officials? Purely from a perspective of how do we be more effective, not just regulating something, because when you regulate something, you assume it's an ongoing activity. That's what the word regulation means. Versus when we take a more comprehensive stance that says, hey, we understand it's the activity that's a problem, but we also understand that there are actors behind this process, and we're going to take aim at the actors. And for the first time, we're not going to settle for parts per billion. We're not going to settle for limiting some water pollution so it kills less macroinvertebrates in the waterways next door. We're going to say no, and we're going to exercise something that's supposed to be a fundamental and inalienable right in this country, which is to govern our own communities the way that we see fit. And that's the question that's come to the forefront here in Pennsylvania. It's not so much about having an agenda and saying we're going to go in and deal with corporations or corporate power or corporate rights. It's about problem solving and folks and communities understanding that they can't get what they want until they deal with corporations, and behind that, till they deal with corporate rights. And that's the final piece of this story, is that when folks begin passing laws to codify what they want, the corporate boys take action. They use their legislatures. They use the courts to come after those rural municipal governments that have made law. And here, that's exactly what's happened. But that's a good thing, not a bad thing, because it's the response that these ordinances draw. It's a response that comes in from the corporations that reveals to people, sometimes for the first time, that this is not a democracy that we live in. Because we live under a structure in which corporate rights trump routinely the rights of communities to decide what type of community they want. And it's that struggle, it's that provocation, it's that struggle, it's that response that takes us into a whole new round of organizing that 2 years ago resulted in the first two municipal governments in the United States passing a binding law at the municipal level, stripping corporations of constitutional rights. Now, under the law today, the U.S. Supreme Court has decreed that corporations are persons. Doesn't make any sense to almost anybody out, except for the folks that put it there in the first place and use it every day to slam down communities. A lot of people ask, well, why does that matter, that corporations have the constitutional rights of persons? Well, it matters in a very real fundamental way. When a community passes a law, let's say these anti-corporate farming laws that were pioneered by the Midwestern states, and the agribusiness corporation is not willing to let them sit because they can't let them sit because they interfere with their model of business here in Pennsylvania, that they sue, and they sue the municipalities claiming that the ordinances violate their constitutional rights to equal protection because the ordinances treat the corporations differently from family farmers. And so the corporations come in. Think about how amazing this is. The corporations come in wielding our Constitution and our Bill of Rights and our Declaration of Independence to strike down laws being made by communities to codify their visions, their wants, their needs to build the type of sustainable, economically and environmentally sustainable communities that they want. But that's the situation. And it's not the exception, it's the rule. And so these two municipal governments in Pennsylvania looked at this, and they said, well, hey, we can pass ordinances on substantive issues, factory farms and sludge and this and that, but none of it's any good unless we can go an additional step, which means stopping corporations from interfering with our ability to make law by wielding our own constitution against us. And so these two municipalities took this, you know, once again, the word radical pops up, but it's not radical at all. It's very logical about clearing the path to be able to make the type of law to codify the type of communities that these folks want. Two communities in Clarion County, about an hour and a half north of Pittsburgh, passed ordinances called the Corporate Rights Elimination Ordinance. These ordinances strip corporations of their authority and ability to use the Constitution to trump the rights of communities to make law. That's been the journey for the past 4 or 5 years, moving from single issue, and there are 1,000 of them out there. We've just dealt with two, and what makes Pennsylvania, I think this works so amazing, is that two issues have given rise to the type of response that we've seen here in the state. Taking a single issue, reframing it into something different. In other words, it's not about factory farms at all. It's about this corporatization of agriculture. Adopting local laws, making law to deal with that process, in this case to eliminate corporations from farming, drawing the response, the inevitable response that corporations throw at this stuff, and then using that response to deepen and strengthen the community organizing so that we begin to move in a fundamental direction towards rewriting this framework of governance that controls these communities.
So do you see your strategy currently as expanding the two municipalities that have had this success to other municipalities kind of at a horizontal level, or do you see it as moving up to, let's say, trying to approach this at a state level?
Well, I think we're starting to drive into the county level. I mean, folks talk, especially environmental groups that we've worked with over the years, they don't think anything's real unless you do it at the state or the federal level. And our news for them, because we've tried to work at those levels, is that those levels are so cooked that at this point we can't have anything to do with those levels, because in Pennsylvania, for example, the House and Senate agricultural committees are bought and sold routinely by the agribusiness corporations that do business here in Pennsylvania. And so the strategy for us has always been, how do you build enough municipalities out there? How do you build enough communities out there who believe that they can do what they want with their community to then drive this stuff into the county level and then drive this stuff into the state level and eventually drive it into the federal level? I mean, that's how we see it moving up. Right now you have about 10% of all rural municipal governments in Pennsylvania who have adopted our ordinances, and who are experiencing any kind of a different level of response from the corporation, whether it's litigation, whether it's trying to push bills through the legislature to strip away local ordinance-making power from municipal governments here in the state, which has been ongoing for 3.5 years. We've been able to fight that back here in the Pennsylvania legislature. So they're experiencing different levels of response, and eventually that response is going to build into something higher. It's starting to now at the county level. We may have our first county that will be adopting a sludge ordinance and then dealing with the corporate response that comes from that. But it's an understanding that at the state and federal level, we are powerless. I can sit here right now in Pennsylvania and say that there's not one legislator in the Pennsylvania Senate or the House that shares my values or shares the values of these rural municipal governments in the type of work that they're doing. I think that's probably similar in most other places. And the key is, how do we develop the force that we need to drive the stuff into the states and into the federal government? Eventually, what we're talking about is nothing less than changing the Constitution, because it's the Constitution where corporations draw these powers from. And so we're not going to get there by just finding a perfect court case and then praying and hoping that 9 Supreme Court justices, or a majority of them, are all of a sudden going to repudiate 200 years' worth of property law dealing with corporations here in the United States. The long-term solution is to rewrite the framework of governance in this country, and that's not quick work. The abolitionists, it took 60 years, and some would say longer. Women's rights movements took 2 or 3 generations. It's a fact of whether we're here to do this work for real or whether we're here just to chip around the edges and change the volume knob. And these democracy schools are targeted towards taking the work that's been done in Pennsylvania and replicating it into as many different communities across the United States as possible. Because one thing is clear, if it's just Pennsylvania doing this, if it's just 100 municipal, rural municipal governments doing it, even if it's just 500 rural municipal governments in Pennsylvania, we will be crushed unless similar work is done in all kinds of different communities across the United States. And so these democracy schools, and we'll have 7 permanent full-time operating schools that'll teach between 4 and 6 schools a year, by the end of 2005 we'll have those in places like Santa Fe, New Mexico, Boston College, Seattle, Washington, D.C., Colorado, Black Mountain, North Carolina, different places where citizen groups have said to themselves, community organizations have said, we're tired doing this work. It's not working. It's an energy sink. It's not getting us to where we want to be, and we need to find a different way to do this work so that we can finally give birth to these self-governing communities that we've always been promised since the early days of the Republic.
And in addition to your democracy schools, your website seems to have a lot of supporting documents.
Some of the history of Pennsylvania, the work that's been done here is up on our webpage, as well as our ordinances for folks that are interested in downloading those things as well. And that's at www.celdef.org. It stands for the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. So it's celdf.org. And there's also a group that we work very closely with called the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy. And their webpage is www.poclad.org.
Where do you see the concept of challenging and or revoking corporate charters fitting into all this?
Well, originally we had a corporate charter program, and that was our focus. We actually brought the first corporate charter revocation litigation brought in Pennsylvania in the past close to a century against the Waste Management Corporation in Pennsylvania to revoke their charter. That was back in 1997. And we, of course, lost that case. We developed some very good briefing materials and some other collateral benefits that came out of it. But we don't see corporate charter revocation as an end in itself anymore. We see it as part of these new campaigns that are moving forward, campaigns aimed at much more fundamental things than just charter revocation. Because in a way, charter revocation aimed at a specific corporation is still seen as a punishment of sorts. And we see the work that communities are doing around corporations to be more of treating corporations as a cancer that needs to be cut out. After all, we don't punish cancer. I mean, that's not the goal of cancer treatment. It's not to punish cancer. It's to remove it from the body. And in this sense, when we talk about corporate charter revocation, it almost pretends at some level that one corporation can be a bad corporation of some sort and has to be removed by having its charter revoked. Well, the point that we're at now is much more comprehensive and fundamental, which is corporate rights, which are, of course, possessed by all corporations across the scheme. And in addition, it's not just corporations anymore, of course, it's the few who run them. Because in this country, basically what we have is the corporate few running the majority. And that's not what this country ostensibly is supposed to be about. It's supposed to be about majority rule. It's supposed to be with protection for certain rights of minorities. But at this point, we have the corporate few governing the majority. And that's so fundamentally incompatible with concepts of democracy that I think that's something that fuels the movement as well. When we deal with charter revocation or bring a charter revocation suit, it really ignores, it doesn't reinforce all of the larger stuff. And that's why we think it's a tool to be used within certain campaigns that aim at the larger stuff, but probably not as a standalone.
Do you see this struggle as something that can be won in your lifetime?
I think we're looking at a conservatively probably 40 to 50 year battle, because it is a battle over everything. This isn't just a piece, just saying, you know, we're going to take 9 years to overturn blank-blank precedent or blank-blank decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. It's much deeper than that. It's about people facing their own demons inside and how folks have been colonized to think in certain ways that only certain things are possible. And we only have really had one other movement in this country that really took aim at all of the fundamentals, and it was the populist movement of the late 19th century. And the populists took on everything, credit institutions, banking. They elected their own folks to Congress. They took over the legislatures of several states. And they did so out of a fundamental understanding that the economy should benefit them and not benefit the corporate few. And for folks that know the history of the populists, they were crushed. And they were crushed with the help of a group called the progressives. And the progressives were the folks that gave us the regulatory state, who decided that it was inevitable that we would have corporations as the norm, and that corporations would be the fundamental unit through which we did our economies and work and production. And it's very strange that we're so colonized that we think the word progressive is a good word. But in effect, the progressives with a regulatory standard undercut, demolished, and trumped the populists who were trying to make some more fundamental change. So we have to face to face with those demons and understand how our own brains have been tinkered with in terms of thinking about what's possible, because we no longer ask ourselves, what do we want as activists? We ask ourselves, what can we get? And that's very dangerous. We have to get back to asking ourselves what type of communities we want and then mowing down everything that stands between us and getting that vision.
All right. We're speaking with attorney Thomas Lindsay. Thomas, one last time, how can people find out more about the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund?
Well, we're on the web at www.celdef.org, and that's the acronym Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. And folks can email us if they have specific questions about the democracy schools. There's a full national democracy school schedule that can be accessed via the webpage. Our email here is info@celdef.org.
Thomas Lindsay of CELDEF, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, speaking with Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio in Seattle. We'll build links to the sites he mentioned on our website on welcomeguests.org, where you can also download MP3s of previous shows and contact us. We love emails from listeners. Our theme music on Welcome Guest is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers.